turning to Matthew, Matthew chapter 19. This is now message number 46 in our series through the Gospel of Matthew, entitled From the Beginning. We'll be looking at chapter 19, verses 1 to 12, and I'll read verses 1 and 2 to get started. And it came to pass that when Jesus had finished these sayings, he departed from Galilee and came into the coasts of Judea beyond Jordan. And great multitudes followed him, and he healed them there. So chapter 18 is a long unit of teaching, much like the Sermon on the Mount. And Jesus gave this teaching privately to his 12 disciples. And so in chapter 18, he countered the pride of wanting to be the greatest in the kingdom when it comes, and taught them humility, not provoking one another to sin, and forgiveness when sinned against. Now, one message that comes through very clearly in chapter 18 is that those disciples should not have been so focused and preoccupied on rewards and position and place, and should have been much more preoccupied with God's grace toward them, that they would enter the kingdom at all, rather than what am I going to have more than these others? Well, the chapter ends with Jesus' parable about forgiveness. And he reminded them that the coming of the kingdom will be a time of judgment. It will be a time of accounting. And he reminded them that while that means that time of judgment, on the one hand, it means reward for the righteous. And we'll see more about that before too awful long in Matthew, in fact. That means reward for the righteous, but it also means punishment for the wicked, and the wicked being cut off from the earth. We talked about how that in Matthew 13, in those kingdom parables, and how there was a dividing and a separating, a severing of the good from the bad, with the bad being cast out and the good being gathered in. And that is completely consistent with what Jesus taught in this parable. And so in this case, those wicked was the wicked servant, the one who proved himself to be unmerciful and unforgiving, showing that he truly had never received that forgiveness himself. Now, one of the major themes in Matthew at this point is Jesus' preparation of his apostles. And we've seen as we've gone through Matthew how that theme has, particularly back to about chapter 10, but really that theme is just sort of slowly emerging and slowly taking much of a center place in Matthew's gospel. And that preparation of his apostles has applied particularly to two different realms for them. First of all, they were the specially chosen witnesses of Jesus. And so they were those that were told to follow him. They were to stay with him. They were to be with him during these years of his public ministry. They witnessed the miracles that he performed. They listened to the things that he taught both publicly and what he taught them privately. They also will go on from here to witness his crucifixion, which he predicts to them, and will predict again before too long in Matthew. He predicted to them beforehand. They witnessed his crucifixion, and they witnessed his resurrection when he appeared to them later. And so they are specially chosen for a task of being firsthand eye and ear witnesses of Jesus Christ, and extending that witness to the Jews that are scattered throughout the world and to the Gentiles as well. So that's one particular realm of the apostles' work that they're being prepared for as they go through. And as we go through in Matthew, we're going to see Jesus being more and more plain that He's going to go away. He's going to depart. And they're going to have a job to do. They're going to have an office to fulfill. And He is preparing them for that work. So secondly, the second realm that this applies to for the preparation of the apostles is that they are chosen, specially chosen, to receive revelation and to teach the law of Christ to those who come after them. When we're looking at these private times of instruction and interaction with Jesus and the apostles, it's maybe easy to lose sight of that, but we want to keep in mind that when He's talking to them privately, these are the only 12 men on the planet who know this when Jesus says they're the only one receiving this message at this time. They're not going to spread this message until after Jesus has been resurrected and ascended to heaven. So they are chosen to receive this revelation and to teach the law of Christ to those that come after them. So that work, part of that work involves the completion of the revelation began in the Old Testament with what we refer to as the New Testament. So part of that work of the apostles is going to be contributing to that. Some they will write directly, others they will supervise, and they're involved in that every step of the way. And part of that work is also going to involve teaching these churches that Jesus said that He would build and teaching them for life in this present age until He returns. And so as we see pointed out in the book of Acts, those churches are to continue in the apostles' doctrine and fellowship. And so this is the important work that these men were chosen to. Now, of course, we know Judas. Of course, he was chosen particularly for a certain purpose, and he did fall away. But nevertheless, they were chosen for this particular work. And so when we see Jesus interacting with them, particularly privately, we understand that it's a part of their preparation and the fact that He's going to depart. So this work that the apostles are going to do, they're going to do this work without Jesus' bodily presence on the earth with them. Now, of course, He promised them the Spirit, and we see that in John's Gospel in particular, the Helper from the Father, who would not come to indwell them until Jesus goes away, until He departs. And then, of course, He does. So it makes sense when we read chapter 18 and we see these issues of humility and forgiveness that are also being applied in a church context, because there really wasn't a church context at this time. Now, people sometimes get very hung up on trying to pinpoint the precise, exact moment when Jesus started that first church. The Bible doesn't give us that, and really speculation about it has produced nothing of value that I have seen. We know that he started a church before He left this earth. We know that He did that. So before His resurrection, this church is in existence, but it wasn't really functional as a church in the sense of the autonomy and being under the direction of the apostles until after the ascension of Jesus Christ. So the point is that Jesus was teaching them something in chapter 18 that they couldn't technically do at that moment. That wasn't something they could actually carry out right at that moment. So it was obviously for the future that He was teaching them this. And they would be able to later, but also they would have the job of teaching the churches this and establishing them in it as well. Now, the preparation of the disciples continues now as we continue in Matthew. And chapter 19 now picks back up another important theme in Matthew's gospel at this point, and that is the rejection of the Messiah. And when we think about that rejection of the Messiah, there's also the rejection of that generation of Israel that goes along with that. So now we come to chapter 19. And chapter 19 opens up with Jesus having finished his ministry in Galilee. And he's coming into Judea, into the region of Judea. And ultimately, he is en route to Jerusalem. And he's not going to leave Jerusalem, ultimately. And that's where he's going to be killed. Now, Matthew signals the end of this teaching section in his usual way. Jesus had finished these sayings. And as we would expect, he returns to some narrative episodes. So we have some things that follow here include interaction episodes, interaction with the public, sometimes some private instructions with the disciples are mixed in. We have some interactions that are opposition, that are conflict with the Pharisees, and that's what we're actually starting with here in the beginning of chapter 19. But the next section of Matthew's Gospel begins right here with chapter 19. In fact, it's going to go through the end of chapter 25. And as you might expect, the section ends with another large teaching unit, just as they all have as we've been going through the Gospel of Matthew. So chapters 24 and chapters 25, sometimes referred to as the Olivet Discourse, is another large unit of teaching that is going to end this particular section. And then after that, well, then from there, it's all into Jerusalem, the crucifixion and the resurrection, and then his appearance and the end of the gospel. So here in chapter 19 in particular now, we're looking at verses 1 to 12. This gives us this first episode. It's an interaction episode. There's the crowds that are involved. It's also a conflict episode as the Pharisees now, they return sort of back into the picture. And we haven't been looking at them for just a little while, but they're back. Now, the Pharisees, we know by this point, they are hostile toward Jesus. They have been conspiring with others, the Herodians, the Sadducees. They've been conspiring with others about how to destroy Jesus. And they've been doing that for some time. This isn't just a recent development on the part of the Pharisees. So they come to him here in chapter 19 and they're testing him with a question. That's, of course, an important part of this episode. They have this question about divorce. And divorce is only one of the most debated subjects in the history of Israel, very likely to get a rise out of a crowd. Probably about the only thing like it that you could bring up would maybe be taxes, and somebody's going to do that before too long in Matthew as well. So, they're really hitting those hot button issues. Now, the debate about divorce in particular centers mostly on the wording of Deuteronomy chapter 24 and verse number 1. So in the Old Covenant law there in Deuteronomy chapter 4, that verse 1 in particular is about the writing of the bill of divorcement. And the phrase there is, if she find no favor in his eyes. In other words, this is talking about a husband having the right of divorcing his wife. If she find no favor in his eyes because he hath found some uncleanness in her. Now that's the rendering here in the King James. Some of the modern translations, I think this is the ESV maybe. She finds no favor in his eyes because he has found some indecency in her. And really when you compare those two, there's not really much difference at all between those two statements. They are equally as general. They are equally as non-specific. And that's really where the issue comes in. The word that's used for uncleanness or indecency is actually a rather broad word. And especially when that word doesn't have something contextually that's constraining its meaning. And the part about finding no favor is also very general and could apply to quite a number of things. So typically, throughout Judaism, they're developed mainly two views of this in regard to Deuteronomy 24:1 and how that it was applied. One view focuses on the uncleanness aspect and interprets it strictly as adultery. So there's something adulterous about this. And so the man can then write a bill of divorcement and put his wife away. Well, the other view focuses more on the loss of favor. She's lost favor in his eyes. And that view typically interpreted that rather variously, including many other things besides adultery. Many, many, many other things besides adultery. And some rabbis even went so far as to say that a man could divorce his wife simply if he finds a better one. She has no favor in his eyes. He finds one that he favors more, and write a bill of divorcement, and you're good to go. So those are the two primary views. Of course, there's some variation here and there, but those are the two primary views that developed historically within Judaism pertaining to this Old Covenant law. Now, Jesus gives answers to these questions, which actually lead to more questions. On the one hand, it leads to more questions from the Pharisees, and then on the other hand, it leads to more questions from his disciples. So we want to look at this passage, and in verses 1 to 9, we are primarily getting the interaction with the Pharisees, and in verses 10 to 12, we're getting the interaction with the disciples. So we'll look at the Pharisees part here to begin with. Let's look at verse 1 again. And it came to pass that when Jesus had finished these sayings, he departed from Galilee and came into the coasts of Judea beyond Jordan. So Matthew indicated that the previous teaching section was ended. All right. So he uses this typical marker. Jesus had finished these sayings. Now, we have encountered this before. We encountered it at the end of the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 7:28. Jesus had made an end. He had finished this teaching. We found it right after chapter 10, where we had that long section where he was instructing his disciples. And so in chapter 11 and verse 1, we find it again at the end of the kingdom parables in chapter 13 and verse number 53. We find it for the fourth time in Matthew's gospel here in chapter 19 and verse 1. And we're going to find it one more time. And that is after the Olivet Discourse in chapters 24 and 25. We're going to find it again in chapter 26 and verse number 1. So Matthew is clearly using this to mark the sections of this gospel, the way that he has structured and divided this gospel of Jesus Christ. And he uses this, he ends all of those sections with this large unit of teaching, indicating once again that it is a single, cohesive, unified teaching that Jesus gave. And so he gives us that indication, but then he also tells us that Jesus departed from Galilee. So Jesus left from Galilee, and he has been in Galilee for a good while, nearly two years time that he spent in this Galilee ministry. And now he's departing from Galilee. He's finished there, and he comes back into the region of Judea. Now, remember, he had gone north, and he would come back down to the Sea of Galilee. So he's continuing to go south, traveling along what seems like the eastern side of the Jordan River. So he's across the river from what is known today as the West Bank, which was the Palestinian area that the British designated when they were still in control. And so they are traveling back and have come to the region of Judea beyond Jordan. Verse 2, and great multitudes followed him, and he healed them there. Now here we also have a return of these large crowds. We haven't seen large crowds that much for a little while. But now we have a return to some large crowds that are following Jesus. And of course he did travel into less Jewish populated areas in the northern part of Israel, and some out to the western coast. He did spend some time in some less Jewish populated parts of Israel, and now he's coming down and he's getting more and more into more predominantly Jewish populated areas, getting closer to Judea and ultimately to Jerusalem. And so now we have these large crowds that are following Jesus again. And notice this little note that Matthew gives us here. He healed them. And that's all that he says about it. He healed them there. Large crowds came to Jesus. He entered back into the region of Judea. Large crowds came. He healed them. And then he's on to the rest of the episode. So we've talked about how that as we progress through this gospel, as we've seen that rejection of the Messiah by that generation of Israel, that though there are still some miracles, they become much less prominent. There's not as much emphasis on them. There's not as much frequency of miracles as we perceive. And then we get a little summary statement here that Jesus healed these of the large crowd. So he was still doing kingdom signs, these messianic kingdom signs. He's still doing those works. But the emphasis is not on that at all as we go through the rest of Matthew's gospel. So then we begin here with verse 3. The Pharisees also came unto him, tempting him and saying unto him, is it lawful for a man to put away his wife for every cause? So the Pharisees, and presumably this would be those from Jerusalem, it says that they also came. The large crowds followed Jesus, and the Pharisees also came to him. In other words, they were seeking him out. Most likely, the fame of Jesus being in the area had quickly spread around. And again, for a while, he had sort of withdrawn and sort of separated himself from the crowds of Israel in much more Gentile areas. And now he's come back. He's come back into the region of Judea. He's come back into the more Jewish areas. So it seems very likely that has spread around very quickly. And the Pharisees, hearing of it, have sort of mobilized to come out and have their chance. Another thing we have to remember is that the Pharisees were also involved in observing him. They're watching what he does. They're listening to what he says. They are constantly looking for something to accuse him of, something that he will be guilty of. And Matthew tells us very plainly that they came tempting him, in other words, testing him. That was their whole purpose. They came there to test him. So they're still watching, still seeking accusation against him. And this tells us also that the question that they brought to Jesus was something that was premeditated. It was something that was pre-formulated. In other words, they've been conspiring about how to catch him, how to find some way to bring an accusation against him that is going to result in his execution and being able to take him before the Romans. So they have thought up this particular question, and it seems most likely they're trying to catch him saying something against Moses. And at the very least, perhaps alienating the crowd by what he says in response. Now, they phrase this question in a very particular way. Is it lawful for a man to put away his wife for every cause? The way that they have worded this question reflects actually the very dominant view of Judaism in that day. As I understand it, there were strains of the very conservative interpretation of Deuteronomy 24, but by this time in the first century, that really was not the prominent view. And I think really throughout a lot of Israel's history, that really wasn't the prominent view. Much more prominent was the view of essentially being able to divorce your wife for any cause or for any reason. And then they might debate about some of those reasons and such, but it was the more broad view. So essentially, they're asking the question, if a husband could at will divorce his wife for any reason. And they ask, is it lawful? And phrasing it that way, they are clearly asking about the Old Covenant law. Verse number 4. And he answered and said unto them, have ye not read that he which made them at the beginning made them male and female? So here Jesus begins answering the Pharisees. And of course you notice that he delivers something of a reproving rhetorical question. He says, have you not read? In other words, he's asking if they had read the Old Covenant law. And that certainly would have been insulting to these professionals of the law. They made their living by reading and copying and studying and teaching and judging cases from the Old Covenant law and all of this sort of, I mean, that was literally their livelihood. And Jesus says, have you not read? as if this is something they should know if they had read at the Old Covenant the way that they should have. Now, actually, what happens here, verses 4 to 6 give us Jesus' response to this question. And in verses 4 to 6, Jesus quotes particularly or refers definitely to Genesis chapter 1, verse 27, and Genesis chapter 2 and verse number 24. So Jesus is going back to the creation account where God instituted marriage. And Jesus from there gives essentially in his answer four reasons why divorce was not lawful for every cause. So he references from the beginning. Have you not read that he which made them at the beginning? And of course he's talking here the beginning of creation, as well as the beginning of the Old Testament revelation, because the book of Genesis obviously began the Old Testament revelation, and the book of Genesis begins with the creation account. So the first reason that he gives them here in verse number 4 is that God made them at the beginning male and female. Jesus says, God made one man and one woman. Now, this is in the context of Adam, the first man, not having any creature that was compatible with him to bring forth after his kind like the other creatures that God made, and in fact gave Adam the job of naming. Now, so you remember how that you go through this process in Genesis, coming out of Genesis 1 and going into Genesis 2. Adam, when he was first made, he was one man and he was alone. He's the only human being on the planet. And there's not that compatible, I think the word is translated maybe helpmeet in the authorized version, but there's not found that compatible creature with him by which he can bring forth after his kind. So Jesus is making a point that God in the beginning made one man, he made one woman. So not one man and many women, not many men and one woman, obviously not a bunch of men and not just a bunch of women. So this first reason that Jesus gives goes back to the very essence of what marriage is between one man and one woman as given by God. Verse 5, and said, for this cause shall a man leave father and mother, and shall cleave to his wife, and they twain shall be one flesh. The second reason that Jesus gives then is that this marriage that God instituted from the beginning of creation, He instituted this, in fact, when you go back and check, before the fall into sin. So God institutes this from the beginning of creation. And Jesus gives another reason here that the relationship that is created between a husband and a wife, one man and one woman that's been joined together in marriage, the relationship between them is a greater relationship than even that with one's own parents. Of course, Adam didn't have any parents, but still yet he said that a man for this reason is going to leave father and mother and cleave to his wife. So the mention of parents then also brings in this idea of continuity. In other words, this wasn't just something for a little while. This wasn't just sort of a temporary arrangement. But God's actually establishing an order here. There's an idea of continuity. There's an idea that the basic building blocks of human society and culture are going to be this family that begins with the marriage of one man and one woman. Now, one of the reasons that this is a greater relationship, as he goes on to say in verse 5, is because of the particular union of marriage. And the language here is a little bit euphemistic, but it does refer to that physical consummation of marriage. Really, God setting this apart as this is a relationship unlike any others on the earth. Verse number 6. Wherefore, they are no more twain, but one flesh. What therefore God hath joined together, let not man put asunder. So the third reason is here in verse number 6. And that third reason is that fact that the two, Jesus says, become one through marriage. And otherwise, the land would be perverted and polluted. And that sort of thing is referenced in other places of the Old Covenant as well. But we also see the fourth reason, which is the last part of verse number 6. And the fourth reason is essentially what God has joined together. In other words, marriage is God's invention. It is God's design. It's not man's. It's not something that just evolved or arose organically in social and cultural context because it was deemed to be more convenient to the survival of the species or something like that. Furthermore, one consequence of this is then it doesn't belong to man. It's not in man's purview to alter or to modify what God has given. Then we look at verse number 7. They say unto him, why did Moses then command to give a writing of divorcement and put her away? So the Pharisees, just judging by their response, seem like that they were somewhat surprised by this answer that Jesus gave. I don't really think they were prepared for it. I think the first question they came with was a premeditated, preformulated question to accomplish a desired end. And as Jesus always did, he never fell into their trap. And he gives them an answer they weren't expecting. And so in their minds, they're saying, wait a minute, it seems like that maybe Jesus is pitting Genesis against Deuteronomy. And they say, well, why then did Moses give this commandment? This is this law in the Old Covenant law, the writing of the bill of divorcement and the putting her away. And they're, of course, here referring again to Deuteronomy chapter 24 and the law concerning that bill of divorcement. Well, Jesus responds to them. Verse 8, he saith unto them, Moses, because of the hardness of your hearts, suffered you to put away your wives, but from the beginning it was not so. So Jesus responded that this bill of divorcement was given because of the hardness of their hearts. Now, hardness of hearts is a very interesting phrase, and it certainly has a rich usage in the Old Testament. Hardness of heart refers to the stubborn refusal to hear and obey the commands of God. It's the sort of thing that says, I don't care what God said. I don't care what God commanded. I don't care what God requires. I'm doing this. That's hardness of heart. And it is used in various different contexts, particularly in the Old Testament. And you think back to that generation of Israel, particularly that came out of Egypt and into the wilderness and ultimately died there because of their rebelliousness and their hardness of heart and their unbelief. So Jesus says that this law was given because of the hardness of their hearts. So one hardness of heart would have been the fact that adultery actually required the death penalty. Deuteronomy chapter 22 and verse number 22. So really the debate about Deuteronomy 24 and that being just about adultery is kind of a moot point. If they were following the law and a husband or a wife was found to be guilty of adultery, they were to be stoned to death by the congregation. But one hardness of heart on their part seems that the carrying out of this sentence was something that Israel was never faithful in doing. And another hardness of heart would have been their hardness in the abandonment of wife and children. And so when you start looking at the Old Covenant law, and not just Deuteronomy 24:1, but other places that have things to say about marriage and husbands and wives and family and children and all these things, you start looking at the various regulations that the Old Covenant law has pertaining to marriage and even to polygamy. These laws were given as a protection for the women and the children who might otherwise have lost their means of support in life and also have lost their inheritances through the means of divorce and these other things. Another hardness of heart on the part of those of Israel, those rebellious, unbelieving of Israel, would have been the lack of love, the lack of mercy, the lack of forgiveness within marriages that lead to ruin. So in Jesus' answer, he's actually showing here that Moses did not contradict himself. And in fact, when you look at the references to Moses as a lawgiver, Moses didn't speak of himself. He spoke all the words that God gave him to speak to them. God told him, write down all these words of the law that I have commanded you this day and command Israel. So Moses didn't contradict himself, and Jesus is not contradicting Moses. Why? Because Jesus, remember, is the greater Moses. And so notice what happens in verse number 9. And I say unto you, whosoever shall put away his wife, except it be for fornication, and shall marry another, committeth adultery. And whoso marrieth her which is put away, doth commit adultery. So notice Jesus' words. I say unto you. Jesus, again, speaking as lawgiver, gave the new covenant law of Christ. He is the greater Moses who was prophesied to come and to give the people his commandments. Remember, he didn't speak like the scribes. He didn't speak like the rabbis. He didn't even speak like the Old Testament prophets, including Moses. He spoke of himself and said, I say to you. And we looked at that at the end, particularly of the Sermon on the Mount, as Jesus is equated them obeying his words with them obeying the Father's will. They're the same thing, Jesus said. Why? Because he is a lawgiver that speaks with authority. He makes law. So we see Jesus speaking that word here, giving his own law. And so his saying, I say to you, gives us this law of Christ concerning the putting away for every cause. And Jesus reiterates that except it be for fornication, it shall marry another, committeth adultery. Well, then this leads to an interaction with his disciples, beginning in verse number 10. His disciples say unto him, if the case of the man be so with his wife, it's not good to marry. So the disciples listening to this exchange, the Pharisees' question, Jesus' response, the Pharisees' follow-up, Jesus' response to that. The disciples listening to all of this, they understood the law of Christ as being different from the prevailing rabbinical tradition. And so they are essentially concluding, if this is so, it's simply better not to marry at all. And so Jesus responds to that in the next two verses. Verse 11, "But he said unto them, all men cannot receive this saying, save they to whom it is given." So Jesus responds here by actually giving some clarification to the disciples. Jesus referred to not marrying. That's what he's talking about, celibacy, not marrying. And he says, not everyone has this. We might call it a gift, we might call it an ability, whatever we want to call it, but not everyone possesses this. Now, immediately, Jesus is explaining that the norm is just as God designated from the creation. One man and one woman marry, have children, and on and on and on. That this is the norm for human beings that God has created to inhabit the earth and to have dominion over it and so on. And so Jesus is also indicating here, those to whom it is given, that some can receive this life of singleness, the celibacy, however that we want to look at it. Some can receive that, but not all, and neither should all. And in verse 12, "For there are some eunuchs which were so born from their mother's womb, and there are some eunuchs which were made eunuchs of men, and there be eunuchs which have made themselves eunuchs for the kingdom of heaven's sake. He that is able to receive it, let him receive it." So, notice Jesus does not promote celibacy. He doesn't set it up as the ideal, saying that really, if you want to be the greatest in the kingdom of heaven, then you remain single. You remain unmarried. You want to be the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. You really want to achieve that high level. He doesn't promote that, nor does he require it. He doesn't require it. He doesn't require it for ministry, as many have gone astray throughout history over that issue as well. He does not require it. He does not promote it. But he does acknowledge that, yes, there are some to whom this has been given. And essentially, he explains how that some have this in one way or another. And we could talk about these different circumstances. Some have chosen it. Some have simply been given to it. Some in their circumstances, it has sort of been put on them. So essentially, he's telling his disciples, don't be hasty to conclude this. Don't be hasty to conclude that it's better not to marry. And ultimately, I believe that Jesus is indicating it's actually better to marry within God's intention and design from the very creation for this marriage. They were not to misunderstand. Well, the way that this episode ends brings attention to the fact that we are to value marriage. We are to uphold it as it is intended to be. It also cautions us against being hard-hearted toward God's Word and toward one another. And it's also certainly interesting the way that this passage immediately follows chapter 18 about humility and forgiveness and mercy in our relationships. But one other thing, and boy, it seems subtle, but it's one of those kind of things that once you see, you can't unsee. Did you notice the expression of Jesus' deity in this passage? He goes back to the creation. He's quoting from the Old Covenant Law. He's referring to the words of Moses. And he talks about what God has done. And he says, what God has done, don't let man undo it. In other words, Jesus says that marriage is God's design, and it is not for man to modify or manipulate or to change. And then he does what? He says, I say unto you, and he gives law concerning marriage. After he just said that God is the one who has done it, and man can't undo it. Moses wasn't undoing what God did. In fact, Moses was being obedient to God in giving the law to Israel. But Jesus, he's God. He's the Christ. He's the lawgiver. He's the one who has authority. And so he shows himself. And again, it could be sort of subtle, but once you see it, I don't think you can help but see it, that Jesus is giving law concerning marriage after he has just gone to such great lengths to say, no, marriage belongs to God. It's not up for the rabbis to debate and to discuss and to determine what the rules are going to be and how it's going to be regulated. This belongs to God. Man can't touch this. And then he proceeds to give law concerning marriage. I say unto you.